Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
What does it take to forge a trailblazing career where you rise to become one of the most powerful government bureaucrats in the country and the first woman to head up the Department of Finance, despite numerous attempts to knock you down? Well, if you're Jane Holton, it takes stubborn grit, self-belief, and a rather pragmatic attitude to cracking heads.
Feminism, by definition, is the belief that men and women should have equal rights and opportunities.
Feminism is about equality, isn't it? It's about men and women having the same opportunities in life.
If that does not suit you, then get out.
You know, there's been a lot of talk recently about whether our country is ready for women leaders.
It takes courage and strength to be empathetic.
Smashing the glass ceiling yet again.
Not now, not ever.
I moved on her like a bitch.
I just don't think there's a place for sexism in our politics.
Nobody respects women more than Donald Trump.
This has to stop.
Hello and welcome to Broad Talk, the podcast about women, power and the wayward world. I'm Virginia Hausiger. This is episode 5 of our series looking at new leadership, a style of feminised leadership that we've seen highlighted during the coronavirus crisis in stark contrast to the struggles of the world's strongman leaders. In a moment, I'll introduce you to a woman whose CV will make your head spin, the formidable Jane Holton. But first, I want to take a moment to say thanks to you. Thank you for joining me on this podcast journey. I really hope you're enjoying the series as much as I am enjoying bringing it to you. And like everything I do, it's a joyful learning curve. So thank you for your feedback and please keep it coming. The best way to connect with us on Broad Talk is pull up a virtual chair at our Broad Talk Roundtable on Facebook. You can find us there as Broad Talk, all one word. And don't forget to hit subscribe on your favourite pod platform so you don't miss an episode. While you're there, if you're feeling encouraging, please leave a review because that really helps us get word out about this series. Now, the incorrigible Jane Holton. Here's a woman who doesn't shy away from any challenge. In fact, in her own words, she's a sucker for them and she's had a few. But when it comes to leadership success, Jane has proven she's almost bulletproof. During her 33 years in the public service, there's little she hasn't copped. She's been screwed over by the so-called merit system and bypassed for promotion when on maternity leave. She's been publicly humiliated in Senate estimates and had her face splashed across TV news bulletins. But she powered on to become the head of the Commonwealth Department of Health and later the first woman to head up the Department of Finance. Right now, Jane is the go-to girl on pandemic policy. She's on the National COVID Coordination Commission. And just days after we recorded this podcast, the Prime Minister asked her to head up a review into Australia's hotel quarantine arrangements. Jane's held numerous international roles, including on the executive board of the World Health Organization and chair of the OECD's Health Committee. She attracted the eye of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation well before the current COVID-19 pandemic, when they appointed her chair of CEPI, the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations. As I said, a stunning CV. But in our chat on Broad Talk, I wanted to dig a little into what made Jane Holton the leader she's become. Typical of Broad Talk, we canvass a broad range of subjects. Dads, failure, a lack of formal training, gender inequity in leadership, who leads well and why, and what compassion and empathy have to do with it. Let's go into a little bit of your backstory before we talk specifically about what you have done and leadership. But what made you you?
Well, I mean, in common with many others, I think the experience you have in your youth are really important. And for me, I moved around a lot. So we emigrated twice. And that means in a funny kind of way, you're always an outsider. You're always, you know, if I'm in England, which is where I was born, I'm Australian. Now here I'm not regarded particularly as, you know, being a foreigner, but in your head, you always slightly are, because in my case, I arrived here as a teenager. I had had 5 years in Canada on the way here. So I've got this sort of, I'd say I'm a child of the Commonwealth, which is about true. And I speak a variety of different versions of English as a consequence.
But do you still think of yourself as an outsider? I'm surprised to hear that.
Well, possibly not. But I have a level of strands in how I see things, I think, which are influenced by those early experiences, by, you know, being raised in Britain by, you know, having that North American experience. And I do find I look at things sometimes not always in the same way that some of my colleagues and friends here do. And now maybe it's not the case that it's a function of those experiences, but I do sometimes think it is partly that.
You've held some extraordinary roles and moved into senior roles and leadership roles pretty quickly, I think. And I know that your father, I think, played a significant role in encouraging you and supporting you. Now, interestingly, when Geraldine Doogue, the terrific Australian iconic journalist, wrote a book called The Climb, which was looking at women and power, she makes this point that there is a common theme among all of those she interviewed, the women, that they all seem to come from families where fathers really supported them and encouraged them. Do you think that there is something particular about that?
Well, I think there is certainly something particular in never being delimited in what you can do. And certainly, I mean, it is the case. And I mean, I have to say, and I think it's well known, that I never thought I would be a public servant.
Even though your father was such a prominent one.
No, absolutely not. And in fact, my brother ran away to Melbourne to avoid being a public servant.
Can I just ask you there, though, what did you think you were going to do?
Well, I actually started work at the university when I graduated and was, you know, thinking of doing the PhD. And now I have to say that I decided pretty early on that the academic life probably didn't have enough adrenaline for me, if I'm going to be brutally honest. And so I joined the public service thinking I would do that for a while, thinking I will, because I was in Canberra. But it never occurred to me when I joined that I would do a 33-year career. It just didn't occur to me.
33 years in the public service is like a degree, though, isn't
it? Well, it is.
It's a degree in leadership.
Multiple degrees, actually. Yeah. So I didn't think of it as being the career that I would have. And I didn't necessarily have a theory about what the alternative was when the academic thing didn't end up being what I decided was right for me. But it was always the case that essentially people kept offering me interesting things to do, and I'm an absolute sucker for something really big, difficult and challenging. And I just kept wending my way onward and upward.
Just on that, I have been reading Madeleine Albright's autobiography, which I'm really enjoying, and she makes the point that she actually says, I was never supposed to be what I became, which I found fascinating. And because she was the child of immigrants, et cetera, and born during the war and, you know, had not a hard background, but just never thought that she could possibly become, as she did, the US's most powerful woman at one stage.
Yes, absolutely.
Did you And you've still got many years ahead, I know, but do you feel that you became what you were supposed to be?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? It depends on whether you believe in nature or nurture, let's be honest. So, I mean, I, as a younger person, I would never have said to you I was meant to be anything particularly. But I think the older we get, the more we see the traits that we have and probably the dominance of genetics. And I do find myself irritatingly like my father on occasion. And you raise the question of, you know, the importance of having fathers, and in my case, parents, who basically never put any limits on me. They just wanted me to do what I was interested in and what I had a capacity to do. My father actually was one of the very few people who really actively encouraged women and promoted women in his career when it was not the thing to do. And so,
I mean, why did he do that, do you think?
He just had a very, I mean, he had a very strong sense of equity, actually. He had, you know, he'd had one of those childhoods during the war where, and this was in England, obviously, where, you know, he watched the privations that people went through. And he had, interestingly, a very, very close friend and female friend. In fact, she was my godmother, my auntie, inverted commas, Jane. And she had genetically, she had a hunchback. And she and her older sister were very, very smart women. And the older sister went to Cambridge on a scholarship, and Jane wasn't allowed to go to university. She was required to stay home and look after her mother and father. Her mother then died, and look after her father. And my father always, always thought that was just the worst thing, that she was denied the opportunity, basically in this case because of a physical disability, which of course didn't delimit her in any way, shape or form, but it did socially. And so he had a very strong view that people should be encouraged to take opportunity and should be enabled to do that wherever they could.
So that informed his own, obviously, his own encouragement, not just of you, but of the idea that that young women should be pushed forward.
Absolutely.
And what about your mum?
Oh, well, my mother was a very stubborn woman.
Has that rubbed off at all, Jane?
It hasn't rubbed off at all. She was an unusual woman. So she had an honours degree in pure mathematics, and she was a computer, for those who know that terminology. And then she worked on the first ever computer as a computer programmer at Bristol University in the 1950s, you know, when they were entire, you know, huge buildings worth. And when we came to Australia, she continued her work. She worked as a research assistant doing, you know, mathematical work and computing work and all the rest of it for basically the rest of her working life. So both my parents were mathematicians. So they were both very adept at numbers, and I got the lecture at the end of high school with my teachers not knowing what my parents did. I got the lecture about doing mathematics at university, as in I should.
Do you know, that's particularly interesting, I think, because you didn't do mathematics at university. And in fact, I think you majored in psychology.
Oh, yes, I did.
And yet you went on to become the first female head of the Department of Finance, and you did not actually have formal qualifications in finance.
No. No.
Or economics.
No.
Or mathematics.
No.
So that's pretty bold.
But I can add up.
but it's pretty bold.
I was
surprised when I learned that, because, again, look, I'll just go back to Madeleine Albright, but she, when she took on, when she'd retired as state secretary, and she took on the role of, took on a seat on the board of the New York Stock Exchange, she was very mindful of the fact she didn't have any financial qualifications. And in fact, she overheard someone on a conference call, she was on the other end, saying, you know, exactly that. Why have we got her? She doesn't have any credentials, financial credentials. And of course, as you can imagine, she jumped in and put him straight. But she does write about this in her book, that she actually felt like, you know, it was a deficit. It was a negative for her. Was it a negative for you, though, heading up the Department of Finance with no formal credentials?
No,
in finance.
No, but what I think I'd say to you, I mean, to start with, you do have to be very numerate. And the thing about a psychology degree is, I mean, if you are not very numerate, you're not going to be able to complete that kind of a degree, particularly at the ANU, which is where I did mine. And so, I mean, those skills and the skills of inquiry and analysis, which of course come with that kind of degree, I think actually did provide me with a very solid foundation. I'd been in the Department of Finance earlier in my career, so I knew about the budget process and how it worked. And I can still look at a whole sheet of numbers and say, what's wrong with that one? Mm. And usually there is something wrong with it. So I sympathise and I empathise with Madeleine Albright's sentiment without having read the book, but as you say it, because I think, you know, you're always conscious that you perhaps don't have all the technical skills of some others. But of course, when you're leading something like a department, you'll bring a whole range of other skills. And if you think about it, I mean, I ran the Department of Health for 12 and a half years. I'm not a clinician. But I do have a relevant degree, as it happens. But I had people working for me who were, you know, medical specialists, and they were nurses, and they were policy specialists, and they were all these other things. And what you learn to do when you're running big departments is you learn to employ all of their skills and their talents. So I don't think you always have to be able to do all of their jobs to do that job. Your job is to knit all those things together, being sufficiently inquiring, and then sometimes sufficiently skeptical. Mm. So I didn't ever think it was a major disadvantage, because I always knew if I needed the technical input, I could get it. But there's a lot to being, for example, the Secretary of Finance, which isn't just about, you know, the technical elements of finance.
I find that very interesting, because as we know, and you and I would know many women who are terrifically capable but won't step up to take a leadership role or a senior role or executive role until they feel like they're formally qualified. And they'll
say – actually, usually overqualified.
Overqualified, yes. But they'll say, oh, no, I can't do that. I'm just going to go and do a master's in that first. Yes. Or I just need to, which, of course, drives me nuts. But what you're saying is quite the opposite to that. You didn't feel you needed to run out and get a specific degree in health, for example.
Well, I mean, I did have a health-related degree, so I didn't feel I did need that. But also, it does go to understanding what it takes to lead in those environments. Yeah. I understand the sentiment that people say, well, I'm just not quite ready and I haven't got all the skills. And I mean, one of the things I've pointed out to so many women, and some men actually, over the years, that sometimes it is about looking around you and saying, well, hang on a second, what skills have I got? How do I match up? Well, the answer is I can do just as good a job. And yes, there'll be some things where I will not be as expert, but that's why I surround myself with people who are.
And actually listen to them.
And take their advice.
Tell me, I want to delve into the issue of leadership itself, but first and foremost, what do we mean when we talk about leadership? What is a leader?
Well, again, I've said this on many occasions. I mean, I think so many people in our communities are leaders. They're leaders inside families. They're leaders in community groups. You know, they're people who can take responsibility, can also acknowledge when they've done things wrong. They can set direction. They can inspire. Sometimes they can harry and harass just slightly if they need to. But they can basically get a group of people organized in a way that's going to deliver some outcome. So it doesn't matter whether we're talking in the absolute micro. I mean, let's be honest, you're leading and organizing and managing to get the kids out of bed, fed, breakfasted, and into the car every morning. That requires a certain sort of set of organizing principles. And I think people dismiss their capabilities, say, well, I'm not a leader. Well, you know, sorry. You know, news bulletin, everyone is a leader. Now, whether you recognize that and whether you practice those skills sometimes on a broader field, which of course, when you're running a big department or even if you're running, running a smaller team of people, you're still leading. You're leading by example. You're leading by encouragement. You're leading by coaching. You're leading by setting direction. And guess what? You're leading by communicating.
Mm. I was speaking at a forum not so long ago about leadership, among other things, in the public service. Mm. And a young woman came up to me afterwards, introduced herself, and she had a very, very interesting job. She worked in spooking or spying or something.
It was the dark arts.
But and she was quite sort of vague about it. But her core job was computer hacking. Mm-hmm. But what was really interesting, she said to me, she feels she's getting a lot of pressure from her supervisor and others to step up to leadership roles and said to me, I don't want to do that. I just like what I do.
Mm-hmm.
I don't. In other words, she was only young, but she said, I don't want to go further. And it wasn't about I want to go off and, you know, do something else or have kids and be a full-time mum. It was just I don't want to have to take responsibility. I like what I do. Is that unusual, do you think?
I know many people who very consciously thought through their careers, their work lives, and for all sorts of reasons, personal, psychological, all sorts of reasons, they have decided that they don't want to exercise and take responsibility in the work context other than for themselves. Now, I think we have to respect that. When I'm having those conversations with people, I always like just to delve a little to see whether it's actually a slight fear of failure or, you know, a real sort of reticence to take a risk, because I do think sometimes when people say that, it's a nice way of ducking those challenges. And let's be honest, it does require you sometimes to put your heart in your mouth and, you know, leap.
Indeed. Let's touch on that. Failure. Failure fascinates me.
Mm.
It really fascinates me. I don't think, and I've interviewed probably hundreds, well, not hundreds of thousands, but certainly thousands of people throughout my decades as a journalist, and I think perhaps the most successful have always had stories of failure.
Absolutely.
Do you have stories of failure that actually nearly stopped you? Nearly had you thinking, I'll pull out, enough's enough?
I've never thought I'd pull out. However, all of us fail. And, I mean, I kind of have a view that if I haven't stuffed up a few times, it means I haven't been trying hard enough. Well, you know, I mean, I think if you're always taking the least risk option and you never kind of occasionally overreach, you're never actually pushing yourself. And I really do need to be clear about this. I'm not taking stupid risks. I'm not taking cavalier, irresponsible risks when I talk about this. I'm saying sometimes either I push myself really hard or, you know, we say, well, let's see how far we can take this issue. Let's find out where the boundary really is.
But have you actually experienced a really bad failure? I mean, I know I certainly have where it look, let's be honest. It sends you home, you cry, you open the gin bottle and you think, you know, I have completely, absolutely stuffed up
here
and I don't know how I'm going to lift my head. Have you had that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Occasions on which I've either misjudged things or I have inadvertently trodden on things I didn't see. Do you know what I mean? Where things have not gone as I would have otherwise liked, and it's been the culmination of, you know, a couple of years' work where it has just literally come to naught. And that is unbelievably frustrating and disappointing. But again, I mean, I think if you don't have those, I think you learn more from your failures, to be honest with you, than you learn from your successes. Because, I mean, with your successes, do you really understand why it went right? Probably not. It just kind of all fell into place. And, oh, isn't that great? And there might have been a bit of luck involved. Whereas, in fact, if you – and this is my point about pushing. If you push and you fail, you think, oh, well, that didn't work. Well, I won't do that again. And I do think you learn about yourself. I think you learn about self-regulation. I think you learn about your own style and how it is you communicate and what it is you're trying to do. And is there a consensus or a view that supports that? I think all of that is about honing down your ability to do what you do. And everyone makes mistakes. And, you know, that's just life.
Well, we all do. And look, as I always say to young women too, that you cannot possibly have a great career without having a roller coaster of failures along the way. And I'm going to share one of mine because I'm going to ask you to share one of yours. But one of mine, years ago, I was very publicly sacked from a television show, and it was in the newspapers and it was all very embarrassing. And I'm going back a long time ago. But I spent a weekend bawling my eyes out and thinking I'd have to hide for the rest of my life. And my father, who's probably a bit like yours, actually said to me something I'll never forget. It was just a very simple thing. He said, "Virginia, no one is going to remember in years to come that you were sacked in this way, but what they will note is what you do next."
Absolutely right.
How you get up and what you do next. Mm. And it was such a kick out the bum, because it actually made me then go out there and confront it, which, and I was terrified of doing that. But I it was one of the best lessons I've ever had. You know, it's what you do next and how you respond, how you manage this. Can you share one of your difficult things?
Well, the trouble with most of them is they can't be shared because they're, you know.
Yeah, you'd say that.
Yeah, well, because they're kind of, you know, probably covered by the Official Secrets Act, if truth be told. I will tell you, though, that I didn't get a particular job I wanted once, and I was so incensed by this, and I had applied for this job. And, I mean, this is one of those classic stories where – and the context is I was on maternity leave. So you're at home looking after this small baby, and that's quite a vulnerable time. And I had applied for a role in the senior executive service. So I was, in modern parlance, an EL2 in the Commonwealth Public Service, which is a director level. So it's just below the senior executive service. And I had applied for this job. I had all of the qualifications. You know, it was classic case. Every single thing, nailed. And I then got this phone call from somebody, and this is a true story, where this was a very senior man who asked me to withdraw from this process. There's a long backstory to it. It turned out they had already had a process. He had already selected two people. The process had been overturned because of technical errors, and I had inconveniently applied for this role. And clearly, he wasn't going to give it to me, even though probably on merit I should get it. And I was absolutely gutted by this experience. And we talked about fathers. I rang my father and said, "What do I do?" He said, "Well, it pains me to say it. I think you should withdraw from the process." He said, "But have a very long memory."
I'm surprised your dad said that, but I guess he was being strategic about it.
He was, yeah. And essentially the point at that particular point was, look, this is wrong, but the question of which fight to pick, this probably wasn't the fight to pick. And we talked about whether this was the fight to pick, but I was absolutely gutted by that experience. I mean, because it actually so disappointed me in what you think is meant to be an objective process based on merit, et cetera, and I was really gutted by that. And it really made me think very, very hard about some of the gender equity issues that I was confronting.
Well, on gender equity and female traits and gender traits around leadership, we're going to talk about that in just a moment. But right now we're going to just take a break.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome back. You're listening to Virginia Hausiger, and I'm in conversation with Jane Holton here on Broad Talk. We're having a fascinating discussion about Jane's life and her extraordinary career, but now we're going to move into the issues around leadership and gender traits. Now, Jane, you have some very, very significant roles in our COVID response. You sit on the Prime Minister's COVID-19 Coordination Committee, the National Committee. You're one of only two women.
Yep.
With the Prime Minister and our Chief Medical Officer, that's 10 people and...
Well, not the chief medical officer, actually.
So he's not actually on that commission?
No.
So there are,
we talked to him, though.
You talked to him, okay. But with his advice and the Prime Minister's input, it's predominantly male, of course, which has been an issue. What we're seeing around the world, though, during this extraordinary time we're living through, is a media fascination with the way women leaders have been significantly, statistically speaking, more successful than male leaders. Now, if we look at the fact that there are only 18 nations around the world headed or governed by women, or with heads of government that are women. The others are men. The fact that about 7, possibly 8 of those nations governed by women are doing well in their response to COVID-19 has got the media fascinated and perplexed somewhat. Are we seeing a new form of leadership here that is proving to be particularly successful because it's different?
Well, I mean, I think there's two things to this, aren't there? Firstly, the question of what it takes to lead at a time of this kind of crisis, and what are the leadership attributes that we actually are seeing as being most effective. And then the second question, obviously, is are those characteristics more commonly seen in women leaders? And I think there probably is, I suspect someone will write a PhD on this. I think you could run that hypothesis, actually.
Well, what are the characteristics we're talking about?
So I think that the challenge of with leading with a very major public health event of this kind is, I mean, you do have to be inclined to take decisions, and you probably, and you can see this, I think, in the countries that moved fastest, they actually got literally an advantage from early mover status. And some of those countries that are doing well, led by women, New Zealand,
Germany,
Taiwan, exactly.
Iceland, Finland,
yes,
Norway.
Exactly. So does this mean that women were more inclined to listen carefully to the expert advice and then basically say, for an abundance of caution, I think we should move and we should move decisively and early? I think there probably is something in that. The other thing, though, I think, and this is so important, is the thing about any kind of major public health event is communication is so important.
Yeah.
And I think we're seeing those challenges around the world that – and I've said this before about Australians, but I think it's not just Australians. I mean, we will all grumble and whinge and have a general old, good old carry on if we're told to do something. But if we understand fully, clearly, and it's explained to us why we must, we mostly do.
We're pretty obedient that way.
Yeah, we are. We're pretty compliant as a general.
But we need to hear what we believe is a true, frank and transparent explanation. Yeah.
Precisely. And I think this question of and certainly Angela Merkel, Jacinda Ardern, I can't speak so much for the others, but they – and actually, no, to be fair, the Prime Minister of Norway, they do not suffer from, foot and mouth or garbled communication. They do, I think, speak empathetically. I think they speak with a level of humanity, and I think they speak clearly. And I think our challenge with these events, and particularly in the world of social media, where misinformation, conspiracy theories, we could just go on, couldn't we, abound, having something that can cut through that and be largely persuasive is an unbelievable advantage.
Well, we've seen it in what I guess, again, the global media sees as or has highlighted as being unique. Things like Jacinda Ardern, for example, using Facebook, late at night, jumping on Facebook and saying, I just want to check in with all of you just to see how you're going.
Apparently wearing her tracky decks.
She was wearing a tracky decks. I actually watched it. But at one point, someone sent in a message, people were writing into her and said, oh, you're looking a bit tired. And she said, yeah, I am tired. And then she said, well, actually, it's probably the lighting here is really bad. And then she said, these curtains aren't very good. I'll move around here. And then she said, oh, have a look at this chair, this old cane chair that came with this house. It's hilarious in that she's just so real. It's like watching. Yeah. It was almost for me like having a Facebook hook up with my sister.
Yes.
You know, it was extraordinary. Not only has she done that, but she's changed the language. Yep. She didn't talk about lockdowns or use war language, yes, and threatening language. She talked about self-isolation and home bubbles and things like that. Mm. Similarly, in Norway, the Prime Minister there held a press conference for kids to talk about what's worrying them and took their questions, can we go to a birthday party, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. So there have been different ways of communicating,
yes, exactly,
that we certainly do not see from some of the nations, led by strongmen. Strongmen. I mean, we know who they are, the US and Brazil and Russia, all, interestingly, and the UK to a degree, which have fared badly.
Mm. And it's funny, isn't it? Because, I mean, in some of those cases, some of those individuals were seen as masters of social media and masters of communication. But I think the issue here is, what is it we're communicating about? Is there a level of empathy and authenticity and actually genuine conviction about some of these challenges? So, I mean, as we would all know, because we're watching it nightly, I think, or every morning, depending on when you consume news, or all day, if it's all day, we're seeing a level of denialism about what's going on in the world and a level of confusion. And I think sometimes that's quite deliberate. Now, I think the thing we're seeing with those women leaders you've talked about, they have faced straight into the risk and the problem that they're confronting. And they are making, I think, a series of decisions about what they believe is best for their country and what will both protect health but actually ultimately economic outcomes. So if you take pandemic, for example, I mean, the evidence certainly from the Spanish flu is that those places that actually went into some form of shutdown earlier actually had less death and actually came back stronger economically faster than those that didn't. So I think what they've done is they've learnt, to the extent that it's relevant, the lessons of history. They've confronted very straight on the challenge that they face. And they're also confessing when they've made mistakes.
Yeah.
Which I think is honest, a huge strength, because I think in this kind of time, a level of frankness, including about what we don't know with the public, I think people actually respect that.
And the ability to also change direction and be flexible is interesting. I think that's been quite dominant among that group of women that we've mentioned too.
Agreed.
And Jane, you've been sitting on a number of international health bodies, organisations and committees for some time. Mm. You're also the chair of CEPI, the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovation. I mean, how perfect is that? I mean, I know you were actually involved in a crisis scenario.
Yes.
Weeks, or if not a couple of months, before we first heard about this pandemic. How extraordinary was that timing?
Yes, well, I mean, essentially, so CEPI was referred to in a US publication a couple of months ago as the hitherto too little known CEPI, whereas now everyone's heard of it. So yes, we've been working on these issues, these viruses that potentially, cause these kinds of problems. We were stood up 2.5 years ago now. So we had got a tiny weeny march on this, but sadly, we hadn't got as much early start. But as a consequence, yes, we were involved in this right from the very, very beginning. We became aware of it. In fact, I was getting phone calls in December about this.
I don't want to talk too much about the virus itself and the response to that, because we'll focus on leadership. But just on this, you, as I said, you do sit on a number of boards and committees around the world on health in particular. It's very frustrating to learn, though, that 72% of global senior executive roles on health organisations are held by men, 72%. Now, what's going on there?
Well, again, in common with so much we see elsewhere in other sectors in the world, and if you think about it, I mean, medicine, nursing, et cetera, I mean, certainly medicine is becoming feminised, but nursing in particular has always been a feminised occupation. But when you look at the leadership in many of those occupations, the leadership does not reflect what you see in the rank and file of people who actually do the work. And that is, of course, a terrible shame. And you see that when it comes to leadership. Now, I'm very fortunate in the board that I lead at CEPI, and this was an absolute requirement for me as we set this up. So we have some fabulous women on our board. We have gender, race, geography, distribution. So I have a fabulous woman from West Africa. I have a fabulous woman from South Africa. I have a truly extraordinary woman from Peru. So I have these amazing women on my board. And not all of them, back to your earlier discussion, are doctors. Some of them, one of them is an economist. I have statisticians. I have all sorts on my board.
I must admit I went and had a look just to check, and it is extraordinarily diverse.
Yep.
I mean, intersectionality is absolutely clear there. We mentioned before the issue of traits.
Yes.
When it comes to leadership. And I want to come back to this, given that we were talking about those global leaders, female leaders that have done well in their response to this pandemic. Do you think that leadership traits might be in fact gendered? Can we talk about those sorts of traits, such as good communication, such as an openness to flexibility, such as good, strong emotional intelligence, interpersonal skills? Are these female traits?
Well, I mean, I think that the question we should ask ourselves is, are there personality, communication, thinking, et cetera, attributes that are themselves gendered? Because I think if they are, obviously women who tend to who have succeeded will bring at least some of those with them when they take to leadership positions. Now, the question then becomes, are they more or less successful as a consequence of that? And do they get advantage from some of those abilities? I mean, my view, and I'll display my bias, is that a capacity to communicate, to empathise, to genuinely hear what the issues are in an organisation, it doesn't make you any less decisive when you actually need to decide if we're going left or right. But your ability to communicate why or to take input as to which, I think all of those things are actually, I think in modern leadership, are very important. And I think what we see is the old-fashioned command-control approach to leadership. Now, in a complete crisis, sometimes that can still be an appropriate mechanism. You don't have a lot of time to go out and consult everyone about which way we should go. But I think particularly when you're leading complex organisations, an ability to really have a sense of the whole organisation. And then, as I've said, I've heard your input, but we're going to do this. I think your ability to manage your way through communication, decision making, and actually encouraging the best out of people.
But are women better at that?
I think they do it in a different way, very often. Now, we should always recognize there's a spectrum here. Some women behave a lot more like men, and some men behave a lot more like women. But I do think the people who can bring that much more, can I describe it as balanced approach to how they lead, I think they will be more likely to be successful.
You mentioned a spectrum there, and I find that quite interesting because I often think that we move up and down a spectrum.
Yes.
When it comes to masculinity and femininity.
Totally.
I know,
right.
I do. You people who don't know you well, but I know have worked under you, have referred to you as being pretty tough and a bit scary.
Mm.
And it has been reported that you have been in meetings with men who've been quaking their shoes, and you've bellowed, you know, haven't you got any balls?
I have never said that.
Oh, well, it's been reported.
I know it's been reported.
Damn media. But look, you know, you would be aware that you have that reputation among some people who don't know you well.
Of course.
Is that you moving up and down the spectrum of femininity, masculinity, or is it just you?
Well, to start with, I mean, I am very clear about where I'm going and what I'm doing, and I'm very clear in terms of how – I mean, in fact, the people who know me very well would probably tell you that I'm not exactly what my media would tell you I am. But it is absolutely clear, and I think certainly for women who've been early in breaking down barriers, I mean, you don't get there by being a shrinking violet. in my experience. And you have to make some conscious choices sometimes about whether you are going to occasionally break an egg or crack a head, or whether you're just going to sit there simpering and let them roll over the top of you. And I think we all know that particularly some men find that quite difficult. But, and yes, you're right. I mean, I've always been goal focused. I mean, if I'm going to do a job, I want to get an outcome. And I don't do a job just to basically have claimed the title. I always want to get to the end of something I'm doing and say, great team, look what we delivered. Isn't this fantastic?
Interesting there, though, great team.
Yeah.
You know, you're focusing on the team. Jane, before we wrap up, I just want to ask you the obvious question, I guess. Do you think we are moving towards a new form of leadership, a feminized leadership?
I do think, yes, that there is a change in leadership. I think the old-fashioned command, control, bark, bellow, issue orders approach is discredited. And I do think that particularly, I mean, you see now groups of men sitting around working out how they can probably lead in a more effective way. And a lot of what they're talking about is what you and I've just been discussing, that some people would describe as feminized leadership capability, which I think actually gives most women a head start because they don't actually have to have that conversation about how to empathize or how to communicate. So I do think we are seeing a different view. I mean, I'm privileged actually in my current life to work with both female and male leaders. And the best male leaders I work with actually are those men who can practice those skills you and I have just talked about. And they are doing a great job. And a bit like we know that boards with good mixed gender composition actually get better commercial outcomes, the numbers are in, guys, guess what? I think it is therefore completely provable that the leaders who have that more diverse set of skills are themselves going to be more successful. And certainly, I mean, I can't claim it's statistically provable in the incidents and the cases that I'm currently working with. But those men who practice their leadership skills in the way I've just described, I find infinitely more authentic and infinitely more convincing. And I see staff responding to them in the same way.
Jane, it's been an absolute pleasure to discuss leadership with you in this way. And it's been fun too. Fantastic insights. Thank you so much for your time, particularly during such an incredibly busy time.
Complete pleasure.
That was Jane Holton, the woman with one of the most impressive CVs I've ever seen, and a woman who just never seems to slow down or tire. There were some really fascinating insights there about leadership, particularly about how some men may need to emulate the communication styles of women to meet contemporary leadership challenges. What do you think? I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can connect with me on Twitter at Virginia_House, H-A-U-S-S, or find me on Facebook at Broad Talk, all one word. And join the Broad Talk Roundtable group, where you can check in with questions, comments, views, news, anything you'd like to share. There's always a seat for you at the Broad Talk Roundtable. And for some great reads, check out broadagenda.com.au. I hope you enjoyed this chat. Make sure you subscribe to Broad Talk so those new episodes magically appear each Thursday in your pod feed. And if you're feeling warmly disposed, please do leave us a review on whatever platform you use. My thanks to the world's best podcast producer, Martin Pierce, a master whiz. So until next week, Broad Chatters, keep talking.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.